Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Malcolm MacArthur is one of Ireland's most notorious murderers. In July 1982, he brutally murdered Bridie Gargan, a nurse from County Meath, and Donal Dunn, a farmer from County Offaly. MacArthur served 30 years in prison and his crimes nearly brought down the government of the day. But he pleaded guilty and there was never a trial. So there's always been a sense that the real story has never been told. People have an enduring fascination with the case, but despite the best efforts of many journalists and writers, Malcolm MacArthur has never spoken publicly about his crimes until now. The man sitting across from me spent long hours in Malcolm MacArthur's company in the last few years. Mark O'Connell, author of A Thread of Violence, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Brendan.
Can I ask you first, are you nervous about the book coming out? Has Malcolm MacArthur read it?
Yeah, you know, I suppose it's always kind of nerve-wracking publishing a book, but there's a whole other kind of layer of difficulty and complexity to this. So yeah, it's a little bit kind of a little bit nerve-wracking. He has a copy of the book. I haven't heard from him. It's early days. I don't know whether he's read it or not. So that's always been kind of a, you know, it's a strange thing to do, to write a book of any length about someone you've spent that much time with. You know, there's a certain kind of tension that arises and kind of comes to a head in the relationship that you've built with that person, and you know, you just don't know what to expect from someone when you hear back from them about what you've written about them. You know, so it's no, I haven't heard back yet. Is the short answer?
Yeah, presumably he will be surprised by it.
Well, he may choose not to read it. That might be the
okay.
That might be the.
Do you think
text.
He's listening now?
Good question. You know, it's likely that someone would say, oh, you're being discussed on the radio. He would tune in. He listens to a lot of radio. So it's quite possible.
And he takes an interest, I think, in himself and his case in a way, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, I think, you know, he tries to tune out some of it, I think. He tries to remain somewhat aloof from the kind of discussion around him. But I think he takes it in and he's, you know, he's very, very aware of it.
You think one reason for the abiding obsession, or two reasons, I guess, that it's about class and power.
I think, yeah, his proximity to political power is very provocative to people. The fact that a man who had these kind of connections, who was, you know, close friends with the Attorney General, who moved in those circles, would commit such a brutal and kind of savage and apparently nonsensical crime, and that, he was arrested in the Attorney General's apartment. That sort of led to this sense of, kind of, I suppose, intrigue and so on. And the class sort of dimension of it, yeah, for sure, that's a big aspect of the kind of mystique and mythology around him. You know, before... Now, I guess he's never really spoken in any significant way about his crimes and about his life. And so all we have is this image, and the image is very striking. The image is one of a, you know, a kind of a landed gentry aristocratic figure with the, you know, the tweed jacket and the silk bow tie and the kind of preened hair and so on. And, you know,
he asked to wear for his mugshot. Am I remembering that?
Yeah,
right?
Well, there's a moment in the book, right? Yeah. You know, Tony Hickey, who was one of the investigating detectives, told me that MacArthur had asked him to tie his bow tie when he was getting ready to have his photograph taken on his arrest and, you know, wanted it done just so. And that's a quite strange and poignant and slightly sort of enigmatic detail.
Yeah, know. And funny then that picture did become a kind of an iconic, I suppose is one word for it, picture in Ireland. So you decided then to try and tell his story. And it's kind of almost comical. You spent the early pandemic semi-stalking MacArthur, wandering the streets of Dublin, hoping to meet him.
Yeah. In those early days that I was doing my PhD, I would see him around fairly frequently. You know, Dublin's a small city and you kind of bump into people and you pass people on the street all the time. And then, of course, when you try to find someone, when you try to bump into someone, I don't know if you've ever done it, it's a very strange thing to do, but it's it becomes a very different phenomenon. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of started writing this book around the beginning of the lockdown, started thinking about it seriously as a project. And that was, of course, the time when everyone disappeared, including Malcolm MacArthur. Everyone was off the streets. The streets were empty. So I spent, you know, a period of, you know, some months walking around hoping to bump into this man and trying to kind of keep to a tight sort of square of the city where I had seen him before. And
yeah. Tell me about the day you approached him then.
Yeah, eventually I did find him. I was about to give up, go home for the day, and I saw him walking up the street. And I think he knew straight away. I introduced myself to him and said I was fascinated by his case and wanted to speak to him, wanted to hear him speak, and wanted to write a book about.
Okay, so you told him this very, very quickly.
I told him immediately, sort of all in one.
He didn't try and run away. Like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the first question he asked me was, "Are you a journalist?" And I said, "And I don't consider myself a journalist. I consider myself, you know, slightly embarrassingly, in a sense, pretentious, but you know, an essayist. That's the kind of background that I come from." And I think, in a strange sort of way, that somewhat put him at ease. And I told him about the Banville connection, and he's fascinated by Banville and by the, you know, the novels that Banville has written.
Is based he, on his,
yeah, he is. You know, he doesn't read a lot of fiction, but he makes an exception for the book that was about him.
Yeah, it struck me you were appealing to his kind of intellectual vanity. I'm an essayist, mm-hmm. not a mere journalist and everything. He is intellectually vain then, is he? And the Banville thing, does the Banville thing tickles him or excites him in some way?
Yeah, I think so. There's a kind of, you know, there's a kind of prestige in a strange sort of way to having been the subject of such a famous and, you know, great book. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the appeal was, you know, not fully consciously, but, you know, I did appeal to his kind of, as you say, intellectual vanity, you know, the PhD thing, the Trinity thing, the previous books I had written. You know, I gave him a copy of my first book, and the book is broadly speaking about transhumanism, and it's kind of science focused in some ways. And I knew that he was a big science guy, you know.
Yeah.
And so he read the book, and he read another piece that I had written in the New York Review of Books. And I think he got the sense that, you know, okay, this guy's coming from a slightly different angle than the people who would have approached me in the past.
And like, I get the impression you kind of even on the street that day, it started pouring out of him, like a person who wanted to talk.
Yeah, I suspect that was nothing to do with me particularly. It was just the fact that I stopped him and asked him. You know, I said, "I want to hear about you and your life and your story. I want to speak about the crimes if you can." And he immediately began. Yeah, there was a sort of a sudden outpouring of these details, facts such as they are, and. Yeah, he almost a kind of, as though he'd been, I won't say he'd been holding it in, because I'm sure he has spoken about this stuff before, just not publicly. Yeah, kind of an unstoppable torrent of.
What kind of stuff did he talk about there on the street that first day?
So that day, mostly he talked about his childhood.
Yeah.
About, he grew up in a place called Bremont in County Meath, and, you know, quite a, not an Anglo-Irish background, but sort of a landed gentry. And he talked a lot about that world, about the kind of social context that he came from and his family and his mum and dad. And yeah, a lot of stuff, you know.
Okay.
He didn't talk about the crimes till much
yeah,
later.
Yeah. And you went back to his apartment building with him that day?
To the foyer of the building, yeah that's right. Yeah.
And you talked more?
We talked. Yeah, I think the conversation that day was about 3 hours. Our conversations, as they went on, tended to be very, very long.
Okay, and then he got back to you quite quickly then, and to continue the relationship.
Yeah, that's right. So I said, you know, I'll give you a chance to... I had written a letter, actually. I was carrying around a letter with me when I was walking around, hoping to bump into him with a kind of... Because I knew that it might be difficult to get my sort of message across. So I had a letter. I gave him the letter I'd given him, as I said, my book. And I said, look, I'll call you in, I think it was a week or something like that. And I'll see how you feel about it at that point. And he actually called me. I'd given him my number. And so he said, look, I read your book. I kind of know, I have a sense of where you're coming from. I'd be happy to talk to you for the book. And I think, you know, he knew that I was going to write this book and I was going to write it one way or another.
Okay.
It would have been a very different book had he not talked to me. But I think from his point of view, he wanted to sort of set the record straight, for what it's worth.
Yeah, okay. And we'll come back to how he might have been trying to do that or what he might have wanted to get across. Mm. So you met and talked a lot over the next while. And Mark, this gets into very tricky territory. And mm-hmm. I know it was tricky for you as mm-hmm. well. Like, you got to the point where he mentions a few times, he actually thought that ye might be friends.
Yeah, there's one or two moments where, because we spent a lot of time in each other's company, you know. I went to his apartment, we talked for many hours, he would call me, usually to go over something that he had said in a previous interview. There were moments, and, you know, I kind of highlight them in the book because it sort of illustrates the trickiness of the relationship, the discomfort of it. And so ordinarily the way I work, I'm usually fairly kind of, I won't say haphazard, but I'll just kind of go along and hang out with people and spend time with them and listen to them talk. I don't go through a list of questions. I don't, generally behave as a journalist would. But with MacArthur, I noticed that I was behaving in a very kind of almost hyper-professional way. I was sitting there with my notebook at the table and there was distance between us, and I was kind of going through my questions to some extent, and had my recorder in front of me and all this kind of stuff, and there was a kind of a veneer of professionality. But of course, that over time, I spent more time with MacArthur than I have with anyone else I've ever written about before, and I think the bottom line is, because of what he did, because of the life that he has lived, because of his notoriety, I think he's, quite, and it was the pandemic as well, of course, everyone was kind of isolated and, he was quite lonely. So I was aware of that. So it was a difficult thing. Yeah. He would sort of tentatively say, at some point, maybe we may become friends. And I would often, not fob him off, but say, it's going to be difficult for you when this book comes out. And, my job here is very much a job. I have something to do here. So yeah, it was a complicated relationship,
Did you like him?
It's a hard question to answer because, when you're, and I, the book is in a way an attempt to answer what I make of MacArthur, what do I think of this man? How does he seem to me? It's very difficult to separate as a writer, a nonfiction writer. It's very difficult to separate your sense of a subject and the material they're giving you.
Okay.
And how they seem and what they're kind of generating from your personal view of them. The relationship was ultimately far too complicated.
To some extent, as a journalist and interviewee, we do judge people on
what you're getting.
Giving us. Yeah. And if you're getting good stuff, you do tend
you
to
like what you're getting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're having to wrestle with that line all the time.
I mean, I loved him as a character,
Yeah.
And I say that in full awareness of how morally and ethically tricky that is. And in a lot of ways, the book is an extended reckoning with not just MacArthur and what he did, but a reckoning with what it means to write about a person, to make of a real person in all their complexity and difficulty and darkness, to make a character out of that person.
Yeah, and that is complicated. We might come back a bit to the ethics of things. Mm. What's going through your head when you're sitting down with this guy that has done these things? Are you at times afraid of him, nervous of him? Are you at times very conscious of the things he did?
Yeah. Our conversations, I would say, 80% of the time, 90% of the time, he was talking about stuff that had very little bearing or only tangential bearing on the crimes themselves. He would often talk about his life or, his experiences as a student in America, his ideas about science, these kinds of things. Sometimes there was a kind of an impatience on my part to get it to the good stuff. But, I had all the time in the world as well, there were definitely moments where I would kind of have a sense of cognitive dissonance of, this sort of very polite, very well-spoken, quite eloquent man is standing in front of me speaking about whatever it might be, string theory or, physics or something. And there would sometimes be this moment where I would realize that he this is the guy who did that, These are the hands that committed these crimes. And it was often very difficult to square those two things. But again, the book is sort of an attempt to try and reconcile those
Yeah, never fear.
Be reconcilable realities. Never fear. I mean, maybe, you know, I certainly spoke to people who thought that I should feel fear. I'm not a particularly courageous person. Anyone who knows me will certainly tell you that. I'm no soldier. But I didn't feel any particular fear. I felt a lot of other things, but fear, no.
Okay, so you mentioned his childhood. He spoke to you about it that first day, and that very landed gentry kind of privileged kind of childhood. And you paint that picture. There is a suggestion always that there was violence in his childhood. Maybe you could just explain a bit about this. There was a suggestion there was violence in the home when he was growing up. He kind of rejected that suggestion, and you explore his reasons for rejecting it, and then it seems to almost change his view on it as it goes along. Just tell me about all that.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose when he was arrested and when he was convicted, a lot of stuff came out in the media. People who knew the family, people often who worked for the family on the estate, told stories about his childhood, and a lot of it kind of amounted to this view that he was neglected, that his father was a difficult and often violent man. His mother was remote and aloof and didn't have a lot of time for him. All these kind of things that came out from people who were not necessarily particularly close to the family, but who knew the family because it's a small community and so on. So that kind of became the narrative of MacArthur's life. And one of the reasons, I think, why he was, eager to speak was to, as from from his point of view, correct that record. He was very keen to remove any sense that he had anything but a sort of an idyllic childhood. So there's two very kind of opposed, competing narratives at the centre of the book. Because from my point of view, my job, or at least part of my job, I felt, was to try and make it make sense. Try and make these utterly senseless acts, these brutal murders, make sense from a psychological point of view, from a kind of a narrative point of view. And, you know, there's a sense in which if someone had a very difficult childhood, if their father was violent, brutal towards them, then there's a kind of a psychological trajectory there, you know. Of course, lots of people suffered violence as children and don't commit horrible murders. But there's nonetheless a sense that, you know, okay, we understand the psychological context here. MacArthur very much wanted to remove that possibility. And I found that interesting, frustrating, kind of mystifying in a lot of ways. His own mother gave a very striking interview after he was convicted on David Hanley's show. But she spoke very candidly, very openly, very bluntly about the violence that MacArthur himself witnessed as a child. So from her point of view, he didn't have anything like an idyllic childhood. So, you know, he's pushing back against not just the narrative of people who knew the family and knew the, you know, from the community, but also his own mother. You know, he would disagree with this, I would imagine, and I'm pretty sure he would disagree with this. But I think my reading of it is that he's trying to remove that psychological explanation so that, you know, he's very invested in he absolutely acknowledges that he did what he did, you know.
Yeah.
He doesn't deny for a second that he did what he did. And, you know, I think there's some remorse there for sure. But he doesn't want to be seen as the kind of person who commits murder.
Yeah. Okay. You know? Yeah. That's interesting though. He wasn't that kind of person. Okay. We might come back a bit more to the reasons and what you figured out about that. But just to take people maybe through the story as you tell it here, and it's a different telling of it, but where was he at in his life when he starts contemplating, that he's going to do this crime, this armed robbery? This is how it all started.
Yeah, so he was in his sort of mid to late 30s. He was 36, 37, 36, I think. And, you know, he'd been having financial troubles for a while. After a long period of just kind of a fairly easy time of it, you know, living off an inheritance, inherited money. So I think he panicked ultimately, you know. And the way that I interpret it, and again, this is just an interpretation, but my sense of it is that because of his background, because of the context that he grew up in, this sort of semi-aristocratic kind of milieu, people around him lived the kind of life that he was used to. You know, people didn't work for a living as such, you know. And his sense of himself was formed in that context. And when he started to run out of money, it was almost like an existential threat. It was almost a kind of threat of loss of self. So the panic, I think, began to kind of rise in him. And, you know, he thought he had a very logical plan to solve this problem. That's an open question, and it's one of the questions that the book explores. What is the logic of this thing?
Yeah, you say quite a striking thing in it, that ultimately he ended up killing those people to protect his leisure time, effectively. Which, you know, it does sound quite sociopathic, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't use any of those terms in the book. You know, I think they seem to explain a lot, and you know, I'm very interested to hear these interpretations and to think about the psychological kind of angles on it. But you know, to say, you know, it was sociopathic, or, you know, there's a kind of a narcissistic element or whatever, I think the danger with that is that you feel that you've explained him.
Yeah.
You know, you feel that you've got the guy. And and I think, you know, one of the things I started to think about as I was writing this book is that you know, mostly when I write about people, I'll spend relatively short amounts of time with them, you know, a few days at the most, a couple of weeks. But if you do like a 2-hour interview with someone, and you write about them afterwards, you can kind of walk away thinking, well, I have a sense of this person. I have a strong sense of this person. I have a sense of their motivations. I have a picture here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with MacArthur, I spent so long with him, and I, you know, we talked so much. It was almost as though he began to recede from clarity. You know, the more time you spend with someone, almost the less clear they seem to you. Certainly with a person like MacArthur.
Yeah. So he was going to do an armed robbery. He figured he needed a gun and a car. So then on the 22nd of July 1982, he attacked Bridie Gargan. That was in the Phoenix Park. So it was actually sunny weather, much like the weather we're having at the moment. Yeah. And as so many people are doing at the moment, she stopped the car and decided to go sunbathing in the Phoenix Park. So he just planned to steal the car, ended up hitting her repeatedly over the head with a hammer. Mm-hmm. He drove off with her in the car then, abandoned the car with Bridie in it, and then she subsequently died of her injuries.
Mm-hmm.
The gun, Donald Dunn, was a farmer. He had an ad in the Farmer's Journal for a gun he was selling. MacArthur went to meet him, took the gun to examine it and test it, basically, wasn't it? And then shot Donald Dunn dead. And, you know, people will be familiar with those stories, but the murders were shocking at the time and still are in their brutality and I think in their randomness as well. So what is his take now on murdering those two people?
How does he feel about it? What?
More than how does he feel about it?
How does he explain it?
Yeah.
That's the question at the centre of the book, and it's the question I kept asking, and I got different kinds of answer, you know. To go back to that, what I said about him wanting to remove the sort of psychological explanation that, you know, he had a violent childhood. He doesn't want it to be seen that he acted irrationally. So from his point of view, he was in a very difficult situation. Things went wrong. He never planned to kill those people. He never planned to commit those brutal murders. He accepts absolutely that he did what he did and that it was deeply wrong. You know, what does he think of it now? I think, to be honest, he's still trying to explain it to himself. I never got a satisfactory explanation from him. I never got a satisfactory psychological or logical explanation as to why he did what he did. Because fundamentally, it makes no sense, you know? He didn't have to do those things. He didn't have to kill those people. It didn't further his cause, such as it was, in any way. There's a kind of gratuitousness to it that defies explanation.
Yeah, so he could have got the car and he could have got the gun without killing anybody.
It would have been easier for him not to kill, in a way.
There seems to be a small element in one way of how he blames their reactions, in a sense, in the moment.
I wouldn't go so far as to say he blames their reactions. I think I think he's probably not fully owning the fact that he chose to kill these people. You know, there's a kind of a feeling of chaos in the moment, and you know, there's struggle, and yeah, it's difficult to say whether he's blaming them. I think always with MacArthur, there is a sense that he is putting a distance between himself and what he did. I feel that certainly, that, you know, that comes across in the language that he uses to talk about the crimes, and that's something I'm very focused on in the book. Well, he often talks about, I say often, it was a rare enough occurrence that he would talk directly about the crimes. But the sort of the terminology that he uses, you know, he'll talk about the criminal episode, you know, the event. He'll talk about the deceased persons, the bereaved. He would never say my victims. He would never say the people I killed. And maybe that's understandable. You know, maybe it would be an annihilating kind of, you know, intolerable thing to speak openly and directly about having done something so horrific. But I was very struck by the distancing
because
effect.
Because maybe that would mean he would have to face up to it, but you seem to be suggesting that he doesn't, he says he feels remorse. Yes?
Yeah.
But did you feel remorse from him when he was saying that?
It's not the kind of remorse that you or I would feel satisfied by, do you know?
On the other hand, there is like the other extreme of wailing and gnashing of teeth is kind of regarding something as a blip in an otherwise fairly morally upright life and not really taking responsibility, which is kind of where we're at.
He cordons it off, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely true. He, and as I said before, he wants to be seen as not the type of person who commits murder. You know, so the murders therefore have to be seen as a kind of an aberration,
which chimes a little bit, doesn't it, with the at the time the assessments of him. There was a lot of talk of that he was acting kind of like almost like an automaton, then his barrister at the time, Michael McDowell, he talked about this notion of a fixity of purpose, which was that once he got this purpose into his head, which was entirely rational, but he did kind of insane things, but in the service of a rational purpose.
Yeah, I mean, that's my interpretation of the phrase. That wouldn't be McDowell's, you know, I just had heard from MacArthur that this phrase came from him. But my interpretation of the phrase, yeah, it was that, you know, he was almost so driven by what he saw as a rational purpose that he acted in a completely insane way, you know, complete sort of... you know, throwing out all his morals, his sense of self to just achieve this end, you know. I don't think it's a particularly satisfying interpretation. I don't think it explains it, but then nothing really does.
Yeah, but it works in some shape or form for him, obviously. Mm. So look, then people will remember that he ended up to a friend of a friend of Paddy Connolly, the AG, ended up staying in Paddy Connolly's flat, which people might not realise, which went on for kind of over a period of days. Bizarrely, he went to an All-Ireland semi-final with Paddy Connolly in a state car during this time, while there was a hunt on for him, effectively.
A state car driven, I think, by a member of the Gardaí. So, you know, he didn't go to the VIP box with Paddy Connolly. Paddy Connolly was in the VIP box and was sat beside the chief superintendent of the Gardaí at the time, and they discussed the case while MacArthur was sitting nearby in the stand.
And yeah, I mean, things like then, so he's caught in Connolly's flat, but then he writes a letter to Charlie Hoy. I guess this is a sign of how MacArthur regards himself, like as a man of, you know, a man of substance and importance. Mm-hmm. He writes a letter to Charlie Hoy, kind of in support of the AG, saying, look, you know, don't blame this man for me, as if he was an important person to write such a letter.
I mean, that's the thing, that's the moment where, you know, you see him in a way.
So I'm getting a sense that you feel you got into his head as much as you could get into his head, but you didn't fully get into his head. Is it ungettinable?
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny, it's a hard question to answer, because, you know, I probably, got into his head as much as I have with anyone, but the reality that the book confronts is it ever possible to get into another person's head? Is it ever possible to know another person, you know?
Does he know himself, though? Does he believe, does he believe most of what he's telling you? Or does he believe this story he's concocted around it?
I think he does. I think he does, yeah.
The Dunn and the Garvin families obviously still live with all this.
Yeah.
Do you feel okay about dragging up the story again and focusing it on MacArthur, on the murder?
You know, it would be wrong to say that I feel okay about it. It's complicated. I feel a lot of different things, you know. Probably the last thing I feel about it is okay, really. You know, I thought about this in a lot of different ways while I was writing the book. And, you know, a lot of this is an aspect of the book, this kind of moral self-questioning and questioning of my own position and what right do I have to tell this story. And, you know, I set out when I started writing the book with the intention to, as fully as I could, tell the stories of MacArthur's victims, of Donald Dunn and Bridie Gargan, and to give them their place in the book. And, you know, they're there. I never lose sight of their lives and the terrible loss. But at the same time, you know, the families don't speak. They don't reply to requests for interviews. And, you know, in the early sort of stages of writing the book, that was a cause of frustration because I felt I needed to have their voice represented in the book. But at the same time, there's a message in that, you know? We don't want to continually... I'm interpreting, of course, and this, you know, I never for a second thought that they were sending me a message in any way by not replying. But how I interpreted it was, you know, this isn't my story to tell, you know?
And they clearly don't want to get involved. Okay.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly, yeah.
So where's your relationship with Malcolm MacArthur at now? Have you spoken to him since you stopped your work with him?
Yeah, it's a tense relationship. It's a strange relationship. I've never had one like it before, either professionally or otherwise. It's kind of, at the moment, it's sort of in detente. It's kind of, you know, there's a bit of, it's tense. But, you know, I always felt that I have, you know, a certain responsibility towards MacArthur. A little bit, yeah. You know, I approached him. He agreed to talk to me and tell his story. You know, I spent so long with him that I, you know, it would feel wrong to simply cut him loose. So if he calls, I'll talk to him. And, you know, we don't talk very often, but...
Okay. So he's in your life now?
I wouldn't go... Well, he's certainly in my life in the sense that I'm publishing a book about him.
Yeah.
I can't but think about him, you know.
But he will be in your life going forward in some shape.
That's an interesting question.
Form,
I mean, I suppose a lot of it goes back to one of your earlier questions, you know, has he read the book yet? And I haven't heard.
Yeah.
So a lot of it depends on that. But yeah, I mean, I would feel quite brutal about just saying, look, we're done. We're done here, you know.
Did this open up a very dark door in you at all, spending all that time with him, thinking about these things?
Yeah, it did. Especially, you know, during the relatively brief but quite intense period when we did talk about the killings and when I was writing about the murders, you know, that's a difficult thing. And, you know, you want to get it right. You want to do it with sensitivity. And it's very, very difficult. It was a strange thing to spend so long with someone like MacArthur talking about these things.
He said he wouldn't talk to you about the murders, didn't he? And he's never talked about them because I think he's only out on license. He's not supposed to talk about it. He can't write a book of his own, all of that. But he obviously did ultimately want to talk about them in some way.
Yeah, he always sort of said, I don't think I'll speak about it. We'll have to see. We'll get, you know, we'll see what happens when we get there, kind of thing. And he was very controlled about it. It's a relatively small aspect of the book when he speaks directly about it. But I think as he went along, he sort of developed a sense that maybe he could speak. And it was a very surprising thing when he did speak about it. You know, when he sort of, he never announced in advance that he was going to talk about it. He just did. But it was a fairly kind of brief you know, he talked about it in indirect ways, lots. You know, it was indirectly our topic of conversation much of the time. But those moments where he does speak about the act itself, they were very, very strange and very intense. And I think it's an intense moment in the book.
Mm, mm. Mark, the MacArthur and the murders and everything aside, I think people will get that this has been a very complex dance for you the last few years, and I really appreciate you talking about it so honestly and everything. The book is an extraordinary book. It is very, very compelling and really interesting. Lots and lots of layers to it. So well done. It's called A Thread of Violence. Mark O'Connell, thank you.
Thank you, Brendan.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.